at Cain's in a trance of boredom. He watched and rewatched grainy, porn-like instructional videotapes in which middle-aged men demonstrated close-up magic passes in front of backdrops made of bedsheets. Magic, Quentin discovered, wasn't romantic at all. It was grim and repetitive and deceptive. And he worked his ass off and became very good at it. There was a store near Quentin's house that sold magic supplies, along with junk electronics, dusty board games, pet rocks, and fake vomit. Ricky, the man behind the counter, who had a beard and sideburns but no mustache, like an Amish farmer, grudgingly agreed to give Quentin some tips. It wasn't long before the student surpassed the master. At 17, Quentin knew the scotch and soda and the tricky one-handed charlier cut, and he could juggle the elusive Mills mess pattern with three balls, and sometimes, for short ecstatic flights, with four. He earned a small dividend of popularity at school every time he demonstrated his ability to throw with a fierce robotic accuracy an ordinary playing card sidearm so that from a distance of 10 feet it stuck edge-on in one of the flavorless styrofoamy apples they served in the cafeteria. Quentin reached for the cards first. He was vain about his shuffling, so he broke out a faro shuffle rather than the standard riffle just in case, fat chance, the woman sitting across from him knew the difference and how ridiculously hard it was to do a good faro. He ran through his usual routine, which was already calculated to show off as many different skills as possible, false cuts, false shuffles, lifts, slights, passes, forces. In between tricks, he tossed and waterfalled and avalanched the cards from hand to hand. He had regular patter to go with it, but it sounded clumsy and empty in this quiet, airy, beautiful room in front of this dignified, handsome, older woman. The words trailed off. He performed in silence. The cards made shushing, snapping noises in the stillness. The woman watched him steadily, obediently choosing a card whenever he asked her to, showing no surprise when he recovered it, against all odds, from the middle of a thoroughly shuffled deck, or from his shirt pocket, or out of thin air. He switched to the coins. They were fresh new nickels, nicely milled, good crisp edges. He had no props, no cups or folded handkerchiefs, so he stuck to palms and passes, flourishes and catches. The woman watched him in silence for a minute, then reached across the table and touched his arm. "Do that one again," she said. He obediently did that one again. The trick was an old one, the wandering nickel, wherein a nickel, actually three nickels, moved mysteriously from hand to hand. He kept showing it to the audience and then cheekily vanishing it again. Then he pretended to lose track of it entirely. Then he triumphantly produced it again, whereupon it appeared to vanish again, straight out of his open palm, in plain sight. It was actually a fairly ordinary, if well-scripted, sequence of steals and drops, with one particularly nervy retention of vision vanish. "Do it again." He did it again. She stopped him in the middle. "This part. There is a mistake."
"Where?" he frowned. "That's how you do it."
She pursed her lips and shook her head. The woman plucked three nickels from the stack, and without an instant of hesitation or anything in her manner that acknowledged that she was doing something special, performed the wandering nickel perfectly. Quentin couldn't stop staring at her small, limber, brown hands. Her movements were smoother and more precise than any professional's he'd ever seen. She stopped in the middle.
"See here, where the second coin must go from hand to hand? You need a reverse pass, holding it like so. Here, come around so you can see."
He obediently trotted around to her side of the table and stood behind her, trying not to look down her blouse. Her hands were smaller than his, but the nickel vanished between her fingers like a bird into a thicket. She did the move for him slowly, backward and forward, breaking it down. "That's what I'm doing," he said. "Show me." Now she was openly smiling. She grasped his wrist to stop him mid-pass. "Now, where is the second coin?" He held out his hands, palm up. The coin was... But there was no coin. It was gone. He turned his hands over, waggled his fingers, looked on the table, in his lap, on the floor. Nothing. It had disappeared. Did she nick it while he wasn't looking? With those fast hands and that Mona Lisa smile, he couldn't quite put it past her. "It is what I thought," she said, standing up. "Thank you, Quentin. I will send in the next examiner." Quentin watched her go, still patting his pockets for the missing coin. For the first time in his life, he couldn't tell if he'd passed or failed. The whole afternoon went like that, professors parading in through one door and out the other. It was like a dream, a long, rambling dream with no obvious meaning. There was an old man with a shaky head who fumbled in his pants pockets and threw a bunch of frayed, yellowed, knotted cords on the table, then stood there with a stopwatch as Quentin untied them. A shy, pretty young woman, who looked like she was barely older than Quentin, asked him to draw a map of the house and the grounds based on what he'd seen since he'd been here. A slick fellow with a huge head, and who wouldn't or couldn't stop talking, challenged him to a weird variant of blitz chess. After a while you couldn't even take it seriously. It felt like it was his credulity that was being tested. A fat man with red hair and a self-important air released a tiny lizard with iridescent hummingbird wings and huge, alert eyes into the room. The man said nothing, just folded his arms and sat on the edge of the table, which creaked unhappily under his weight. For lack of a better idea, Quentin tried to coax the lizard to land on his finger. It flew down and nipped a tiny chunk out of his forearm, drawing a dot of blood, then zipped away and buzzed against the window like a bumblebee. The fat man silently handed Quentin a Band-Aid, collected his lizard, and left. Finally, the door closed and didn't open again. Quentin took a deep breath and rolled his shoulders. Apparently the procession had ended, though nobody bothered to say anything to Quentin. At least he had a few minutes to himself. By now the sun was setting. He couldn't see it from the exam room, but he could see a fountain, and the light reflected in the pool of the fountain was a cool, burnt orange. A mist was rising up through the trees. The grounds were deserted. He rubbed his face with his hands. His head was clearing. It occurred to him, long after it probably should have, to wonder what the hell his parents were thinking. Normally they were pretty indifferent to his comings and goings, but even they had their limits. School had been out for hours now. Maybe they thought his interview had run long, though the chances that they even remembered Quentin was supposed to have had an interview were pretty small. Or if it was summer here, maybe school hadn't even started yet? The giddy haze he'd been lost in all afternoon was starting to dissipate. He wondered exactly how safe he was here. If this was a dream, he was going to have to wake up pretty soon. Through the closed door, he distinctly heard the sound of somebody crying. A boy, and way too old to be crying in front of other people. A teacher was speaking to him quietly and firmly, but the boy either wouldn't or couldn't stop. He ignored it, but it was a dangerous, unmanning sound, a sound that clawed away at the outer layers of Quentin's hard-won teenage sang-froid. Underneath it, there was something like fear. The voices faded as the boy was led away. Quentin heard the dean speaking in icy, clipped tones, trying not to sound angry. I'm really not sure I care one way or the other anymore.
There was an answer, something inaudible.
If we don't have a quorum, we'll simply send them all home and skip a year.
Fogg's genteel reserve was decaying.
Nothing would make me happier. We can rebuild the observatory. We can turn the school into a nursing home for senile old professors. God knows we have enough of those.
Inaudible.
There is a 20th, Melanie. We go through this every year, and we will empty every high school and middle school and juvenile detention center till we find him or her or it. And if there isn't, I will happily resign, and it will be your problem, and you're welcome to it. Right now, I can't think of anything that would make me happier.
The door opened a crack, and for an instant a worried face peered in at him. It was Quentin's first examiner, the dark-haired European lady with the clever fingers. He opened his mouth to ask about a phone. His cell was down to one useless flickering bar. But the door shut again. How annoying. Was it over? Should he just leave? He made a face to himself. He was all for adventures, God knows, but enough was enough. This one was getting old. The room was almost dark. He looked around for a light switch, but there wasn't one. In fact, all the time he'd been here, he hadn't seen a single electrical device. No phones, no lights, no clocks. It was a long time since Quentin had had his sandwich and his square of dark chocolate, and he was hungry again. He stood up and went to the window where it was lighter. The panes of glass were wiggly with age. Was he the last one left? What was taking so long? The sky was a luminous royal blue dome swarming with huge, lazy whorls of stars, Van Gogh stars that would have been invisible in Brooklyn, drowned in light pollution. He wondered how far upstate they were, and what had happened to the note he'd been chasing and never found, the book he'd left behind with his backpack in the first exam room. Now he wished he'd kept it with him. He imagined his parents making dinner together in the kitchen, something steaming on the stove, his dad singing along to something nightmarishly unhip, two glasses of red wine on the counter. He almost missed them. With no warning, the door banged open and the dean walked in, talking over his shoulder at somebody behind him.
"A candidate?" "Fine," he said sarcastically. "Let's see a candidate and bring some goddamn candles."
He sat down at the table. His shirt was translucent with sweat. It was not impossible that he'd had a drink between now and the last time Quentin had seen him.
"Hello, Quentin. Please sit."
He indicated the other chair. Quentin sat, and Fogg rebuttoned his top button and hastily, irritably whipped a tie out of his pocket. The dark-haired woman followed Fogg into the room, and after her came the old man with the knots, the fat man with the lizard, then the rest of the dozen or so men and women who had paraded through the room this afternoon. They formed lines along the walls, packed themselves into the corners, craning to look at him, whispering to one another. The punk kid with the tattoos was there, too. He slipped in just as the door was closing, unobserved by the faculty.
"Come on, come on," the dean waved them into the room. "We should really do this in the conservatory next year. Pearl, you come around here."
This to the young blonde woman who had made Quentin draw a map.
"Now," he said when they were all inside. "Quentin, sit, please."
Quentin was already sitting. He scooched in his chair a little farther. Dean Fogg took out of one pocket a fresh pack of cards, the plastic wrap still on them, and from the other he took a stack of nickels, maybe a dollar's worth, which he put down too emphatically so that they promptly slumped over. They both reached to restack them.
"All right, let's get to it."
Fogg clapped his hands and rubbed them together.
"Let's see some magic."
He sat back in his chair and folded his arms. Hadn't they already done this part? Quentin kept his face studiously calm and unworried,
but his mind was in free fall. Slowly he unwrapped the stiff new cards, the plastic crackling deafeningly in the excruciating stillness, and watched from a mental mile away as his hands dutifully riffled and bridged them, riffled and bridged. He searched his brain for a trick he hadn't already done the first time around. Somebody coughed. He'd barely started his routine when Fogg stopped him.
"No, no, 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 no," Fogg chuckled, not especially kindly. "Not like that. I want to see some real magic."
He knocked twice on the hard tabletop with his knuckles and sat back again. Quentin took a deep breath and searched Fogg's face for the good humor he'd seen there earlier, but Fogg just watched expectantly. His eyes were a pale, milky blue, paler than eyes usually were.
"I don't really get what you mean," Quentin said slowly in the silence, like he had forgotten his line in the school play and had to ask for it. "What do you mean, real magic?"
"Well, I don't know," Fogg shot a hilarious sideways glance at the other teachers. "I don't know what I mean. You tell me what I mean." Quentin shuffled a couple more times, stalling. He didn't know what to do. He would do anything if they would just tell him what he was supposed to do. This was it, he thought. He was coming to the end. This is what failure feels like. He looked around the room, but every face was either blank or avoiding his gaze. No one was going to help him. He was going back to Brooklyn. Maddeningly, he could feel tears pooling in his eyes. He blinked them away. He so badly wanted not to care, but he was falling backward, sinking down inside himself, and there was nothing there to catch him. "This is it," he thought. This was the test he couldn't pass. It wasn't really all that surprising. He just wondered how long they were going to let it go on.
"Stop fucking with us, Quentin," Fogg barked. He snapped his fingers. "Come on, wake up."
He reached across the table and grabbed Quentin's hands roughly. The contact was a shock. His fingers were strong and strangely dry and hot. He was moving Quentin's fingers, physically forcing them into positions they didn't want to be in.
"Like this," he was saying. "Like this. Like this."
"Okay, stop," Quentin said. He tried to pull away. "Stop!" But Fogg didn't stop. The audience shifted uncomfortably, and somebody said something. Fogg kept on working Quentin's hands with both of his, kneading them. He bent Quentin's fingers back, stretching them apart so that the webs between his fingers burned. Light seemed to flash between their hands.
"I said stop it!"
Quentin jerked his hands away. It was surprising how good the anger felt. It was something to grab onto. In the shocked silence that followed, he took a deep breath and forced it out through his nose. When it was out, he felt like he'd expelled some of his despair with it. He'd had enough of being judged. He'd been sucking it up his whole life, but even he had his limit. Fogg was talking again, but now Quentin wasn't even listening. He had begun to recite something under his breath, something familiar. It took him a second to realize that the words he was mouthing weren't English. They were from the foreign language he had invented earlier that afternoon. It was an obscure language, he'd decided, indigenous to a single tropical archipelago, a languorous hot-weather paradise, a Gauguin painting, blessed with black sand beaches and breadfruit trees and freshwater springs, and endowed with an angry, glowing red volcano god and an oral culture rich in obscene expletives. He spoke this language fluently, with no accent, like a native. The words he spoke were not a prayer, exactly, more of an incantation. Quentin stopped shuffling the cards. There was no going back. Everything snapped into very slow, slow motion, as if the room had filled up with a viscous but perfectly clear liquid in which everyone and everything floated easily and calmly, everyone and everything except for Quentin, who moved quickly. With two hands together, as if he were releasing a dove, he tossed the deck of cards lightly up to the ceiling. The deck broke apart and scattered in flight, like a meteorite losing cohesion in the atmosphere, and as the cards fluttered back down to earth, they stacked themselves on the tabletop. They formed a house of cards. It was a recognizable, if impressionistic, model of the building they were sitting in. The cards fell as if by chance, but each one perfectly, snapping into place magnetically, edge to edge, one after other. The last two, the aces of spades and hearts, leaned up against each other to make the roof over the clock tower. Now the room was absolutely still. Dean Fogg sat as if he were frozen in place. All the hairs were standing up on Quentin's arms, but he knew what he was doing. His fingers left almost imperceptible phosphorescent trails behind them in the air. He definitely felt high. He leaned forward and blew lightly on the card house, and it collapsed back down into a neatly stacked deck. He turned the deck over and fanned it out on the table like a blackjack dealer. Every card was a queen. All the standard suits, plus other suits that didn't exist, in different colors, green and yellow and blue. The queen of horns, the queen of clocks, the queen of bees, the queen of books. Some were clothed, some were shamelessly naked. Some of them had Julia's face. Some of them had the lovely paramedics. Dean Fogg watched Quentin intently. Everybody watched him. Watch this. Quentin squared the deck again and, with no particular effort, ripped it in half and then ripped the halves in half and tossed the resulting confetti at the assembled company, who all flinched except for Fogg. He stood up. His chair fell over backward.
"Tell me where I am," Quentin said softly. "Tell me what I'm doing here."
He picked up the stack of nickels in his fist, only it was no longer a stack of coins. It was the hilt of a bright, burning sword that he drew easily out of the tabletop as if it had been left there, buried up to the hilt.
"Tell me what's going on here," Quentin said, louder, to the room. "And if this place isn't fillery, then for fuck's sake will somebody please tell me where the hell I am?"
Quentin let the tip of the sword hover under Fogg's nose for a slow 10 count. Then he reversed his grip and stabbed it down into the wood of the table. The point bit deep into the buttery wood and stuck there. Fogg didn't move. The sword waggled in place. Quentin sniffed involuntarily. The last of the light from the window died. It was night.
"Well now," the dean said finally.
He removed a neatly folded handkerchief from his pocket and patted his forehead.
"I think we can all agree that that was a pass."
Somebody, it was the old guy with the knots, put a reassuring hand on Quentin's back and gently, with surprising strength, drew the sword out of the table and laid it safely on its side. A slow patter of applause arose from the assembled examiners. It quickly turned into an ovation. Elliot. Afterward, Quentin couldn't remember much of the rest of that night, except that he spent it there at the school. He was exhausted and weak, like he'd been drugged. His chest felt hollowed out and empty. He wasn't even hungry anymore, just desperate to sleep. It was embarrassing, but nobody seemed to mind. Professor van der Veya, it turned out that was the dark-haired woman's name, told him it was perfectly natural to be tired because he had just cast his first minor incantation, whatever that was, and that would wear anybody out. She further promised him that matters had been squared with his parents. They wouldn't be worried. By that point, Quentin barely cared. He just wanted to pass out. He let her half-lead, half-carry him up approximately 10,000 flights of stairs to a small, neat room containing a very, very soft feather bed with cool, white sheets. He lay down on it with his shoes still on. Ms. van der Veya took them off for him. It made him feel like a little kid to have somebody untie his shoes for him. She covered him up, and he was asleep before she closed the door. The next morning it took him a long, confused minute to figure out where he was. He lay in bed, slowly piecing together his memories of the day before. It was a Friday, and by rights he should be in school now. Instead, he was waking up in an unfamiliar bedroom, wearing yesterday's clothes. He felt vaguely confused and regretful, like he'd drunk too much at a party with people he didn't know very well and fallen asleep in the host's spare bedroom. He even had a trace of what felt like a hangover. What exactly had happened last night? What had he done? His memories were all wrong. The events were like a dream. They had to be, but they didn't feel like a dream. And this room wasn't a dream. A crow cawed loudly outside and immediately stopped as if it were embarrassed. There was no other sound. From where he lay, he took stock of the room he was in. The walls were curved. The room was in the shape of an arc of a circle. The outer wall was stone. The inner was taken up with dark wooden cabinets and cubbies. There was a Victorian-looking writing desk and a dresser and a mirror. His bed was tucked into a wooden alcove. There were small vertical windows all along the outer wall. He had to admit it was a highly satisfactory room. No danger signs yet. Maybe this wasn't a complete disaster. At any rate, it was time to get up, time to get it over with and find out what was going on. He got up and padded over to a window. The stone floor was cool on his bare feet. It was early, a misty dawn, and he was very high up, higher than the tops of the highest trees. He had slept for 10 hours. He looked down on the green lawn. It was silent and empty. He saw the crow. It drifted by below him on glossy blue-black wings. A note on the desk informed him that he would be having breakfast with Dean Fogg at his earliest convenience. Quentin discovered a dormitory-style bathroom on the floor below, with shower stalls and rows of capacious white porcelain sinks and stacks of neatly folded, scratchy white institutional towels. He washed up. The water was hot and strong, and he let it blast him till he felt clean and calm. He took a long, pent-up acid-yellow piss in the shower and watched it spiral down the drain. It felt deeply weird not to be in school, to be on an adventure somewhere new, however dubious. It felt good. A mental meter in his brain was totting up the damage that his absence would be wreaking at home in Brooklyn. So far it was still within acceptable limits. He made himself as presentable as possible in his day-old slept-in interview suit and walked downstairs. The place was completely deserted. He hadn't expected a formal reception exactly, but he had to wander around for 20 minutes through empty hallways and drawing rooms and classrooms and out onto terraces before the white-gloved butler who'd served him his sandwich yesterday finally found him and deposited him in the dean's office, which was surprisingly small and mostly taken up by a presidential desk the size of a panzer tank. The walls were lined with an assortment of books and old-looking brass instruments. The dean arrived a minute later, wearing a light green linen suit and a yellow tie. He was brusque and peppy, and showed no sign of embarrassment or any other emotion relating to the scene the night before. He had already had breakfast, Fogg explained, but Quentin would eat while they talked. "Now," he clapped his hands on his knees and quirked his eyebrows, "first things first. Magic is real, but you've probably already gotten that far." Quentin said nothing. He kept his face, his whole body, carefully still in his chair. He looked at a spot over Fogg's shoulder. He was giving nothing away. Certainly it was the simplest possible explanation for what had happened last night. Part of him, the part he trusted least, wanted to leap on this idea like a puppy on a ball. But in light of everything else that had ever happened to him in his entire life, he checked himself. He'd spent too long being disappointed by the world. He'd spent so many years pining for something like this, some proof that the real world wasn't the only world, and coping with the overwhelming evidence that it, in fact, was. He wasn't going to be suckered in just like that. It was like finding a clue that somebody you'd buried and mourned wasn't really dead, after all. He let Fogg talk. "To answer your questions of last night, you are at the Brakebills College for Magical Pedagogy." The butler arrived with a tray crowded with covered dishes, which he busily uncovered like a room service waiter. "Based on your performance in the examination yesterday, we've decided to offer you a place here. Try the bacon. It's very good. Local farm. They raise the pigs on cream and walnuts."
"You want me to go to school here?"
"College."
"Yes. You'd come here instead of matriculating at a conventional university. If you like it, you can even keep the room you stayed in last night."
"But I can't just..."
Quentin didn't know exactly how to put everything that was ridiculous about that idea in a single sentence.
"I'm sorry, this is a little confusing. So I would put off college?"
"No, Quentin, you wouldn't put off college. You would abandon college. Brakebills would be your college."
The dean had obviously had a lot of practice at this. "There would be no Ivy League for you. You wouldn't go off to school with the rest of your class. You would never make Phi Beta Kappa or be recruited by a hedge fund or a management consultancy. This isn't summer school, Quentin. This is..."
He pronounced the phrase precisely, eyes wide.
"The whole shebang."
"So it's 4 years?"
"Five, actually."
"At the end of which I get what? A bachelor's of magic?"
It was actually funny.
"I can't believe I'm having this conversation," he said to nobody.
"At the end of which you'll be a magician, Quentin. It is not the obvious career path, I know. Your guidance counselor would not approve. No one will know what you're doing here. You would be leaving all that behind. Your friends, whatever career plans you had, everything. You would be losing one world, but gaining another. Brakebills would become your world. It's not a decision to be taken lightly."
"Well, no, it wasn't." Quentin pushed his plate away and crossed his arms. He stalled.
"So, how did you find me?"
"Oh, we have a device for that. A globe."
Fogg indicated a shelf holding a whole menagerie of them. Modern globes, blackwater globes, pale lunar globes, glittering midnight blue celestial globes, dark, smoky, unreadable globes awash with ludicrously inaccurate continents.
"It finds young people like yourself who have an aptitude for magic. Essentially, it senses magic being performed, often inadvertently, by unregistered sorcerers, of which you are one. I suppose it must have picked up that wandering nickel trick of yours. We have scouts, too," he added. "Your odd friend Ricky with the whiskers is one.
He touched his jawline where Ricky's Amish beard was.
"What about that woman I met with the braids, the paramedic? Was she a scout, too?"
Fogg frowned.
"With braids? You saw her?"
"Well, yes, right before I came here. Didn't you send her?"
Fogg's face became studiously empty.
"In a manner of speaking, she's a special case. Works on an independent basis. Freelance, you might say."
Quentin's mind spun. Maybe he should ask to see a brochure. And no one had said anything about tuition yet. And gift horses and all that notwithstanding, how much did he know about this place? Suppose it really was a school for magic. Was it any good? What if he'd stumbled into some third-tier magic college by accident? He had to think practically. He didn't want to be committing himself to some community college of sorcery when he could have Magic Harvard or whatever.
"Don't you want to see my SATs?"
"I have," Fogg said patiently, "and a lot more than that. But yesterday's exam was all we really needed. It's very comprehensive. Admission here is quite competitive, you know. I doubt there's a more exclusive school of any kind on the continent. We held 6 exams this summer for 20 places. Only 2 passed yesterday, you and another boy, the boy with the tattoos and the hair. Penny, he says his name is. Can't be his real name." "This is the only magical school in North America," Fogg went on, leaning back behind his desk. He almost seemed to be enjoying Quentin's discomfort. "There's 1 in the UK, 2 on the continent, 4 in Asia, and so on. 1 in New Zealand, for some reason. People talk a lot of guff about American magic, but I assure you, we are quite up to the international standard. In Zurich, they still teach phrenology, if you can believe that."
Something small but heavy fell off Fogg's desk with a clunk. He bent to retrieve it. A silver statue of a bird that seemed to be twitching.
"Poor little thing," he said, petting it with his large hands. "Someone tried to change it into a real bird, but it got stuck in between. It thinks it's alive, but it's much too heavy to fly."
The metal bird cheeped feebly, a dry clicking noise like an empty pistol. Fogg sighed and put it away in a drawer.
"It's always launching itself out of windows and landing in the hedges." "Now," the dean leaned forward and steepled his fingers, "should you choose to matriculate here, we'll do some minor illusion work with your parents. They can't know about break bills, of course, but they'll think you've been accepted to a very prestigious private institute, which isn't at all far from the truth, and they'll be very proud. It's painless and quite effective as long as you don't say anything too obvious. Oh, and you'll start right away. The semester begins in 2 weeks, so you'll have to skip the rest of your senior year. But I really shouldn't be telling you all this before we've done your paperwork."
Fogg took out a pen and a fat sheaf of closely handwritten paper that looked like a treaty between 2 18th-century nation-states.
"Penny signed yesterday," he said. "Very quick examination, that boy. What do you say?"
So that was it. That was the sales pitch. Fogg put the papers in front of him and held out the pen. Quentin took it, a fancy-looking metal fountain pen as thick as a cigar. His hand hovered over the page. This was ridiculous. Was he really going to throw everything away? Everything? Everybody he knew, James and Julia, whatever college he would have gone to, whatever career he would have had, everything he thought he'd been getting ready for. For this? This bizarre charade? This fever dream? This fancy dress role-playing game? He stared out the window. Fogg watched him impassively, just waiting for him to fall for it. If he cared one way or the other, he wasn't letting on. The little floundering metal bird, having escaped its drawer, butted its head industriously against the wainscoting. And then a vast, stony weight suddenly lifted off Quentin's chest. It felt like it had been there his entire life,
an invisible albatross, a granite millstone holding him down, and all at once it just dropped away and disappeared without a splash. His chest expanded. He was going to bob up to the ceiling like a balloon. They were going to make him a magician. And all he had to do was sign. Jesus, what the hell was he thinking? Of course he was going to sign. This was everything he'd always wanted, the break he'd given up on years ago. It was right in front of him. He was finally on the other side, down the rabbit hole, through the looking glass. He was going to sign the papers, and he was going to be a motherfucking magician. Or what the hell else was he going to do with his life?
Okay, Quentin said evenly. All right. On one condition. I want to start now. I want to stay in that room. I don't want to go home. They didn't make him go home. Instead, his things arrived from home in a collection of duffel bags and rolly suitcases packed by his parents, who had, as Fogg promised, somehow been squared with the idea that their only child was suddenly matriculating in the middle of the semester at a mysterious educational institution they had never visited or even heard of. Quentin slowly unpacked his clothes and his books and put them away in the cabinets and cubbies in the little curved tower room. He didn't even want to touch them now. They were part of his old self, his old life, the one he was molting away. The only thing missing was the book, the notebook the paramedic gave him. That was nowhere to be found. He'd left it in the exam room on the assumption that he'd be going back there, but when he finally did, it was gone. Dean Fogg and the butler pled ignorance. Sitting there alone in his room, his folded clothes around him on the bed, he thought about James and Julia. God only knew what they were thinking. Did she miss him? Now that he was gone, would she realize she'd had the wrong man all along? He should probably get in touch with them somehow. Though really, what the hell could he say? He wondered what would have happened if James had taken the envelope from the paramedic, too. Maybe he would have gotten to take the exam, too. Maybe that was part of the test. He let himself unclench a little. Just slightly, he stopped bracing for the blow from above, and for the first time, he seriously considered the idea that it might not come at all. With nothing else to do, Quentin roamed through the huge house, unsupervised and rudderless. The dean and the teachers were nice enough when he ran into them, but they had their own work to do and their own problems to deal with. It was like being at a fancy beach resort during the off-season, rattling around in a grand hotel with no guests, just empty rooms and empty gardens and empty, echoing hallways. He ate his meals alone in his room and loitered in the library. Naturally, they had the complete works of Christopher Plover, and luxuriously contemplated, one by one, in order, each of the problem sets and projects and papers he would never have to finish. Once he found his way up to the clock tower and spent an afternoon watching the huge, rusty iron pendulum sway back and forth, following the massive gears and levers and catchments as they turned and meshed, carrying out their mechanical syllogism, until the glow of the setting sun shone through the tremendous backward clock face. Sometimes he burst out laughing out of nowhere, for no reason. He was experimenting cautiously with the idea of being happy, dipping an uncertain toe into those intoxicatingly carbonated waters. It wasn't something he'd had much practice at. It was just too fucking funny. He was going to learn magic. He was either the greatest genius of all time or the biggest idiot. But at least he was actually curious about what was going to happen to him next. For the first time, and he didn't know how long, he was actually following the action with interest. In Brooklyn, reality had been empty and meaningless. Whatever inferior stuff it was made of, meaning had refused to adhere to it.
Break bills was different. It mattered. Meaning. Is that what magic was? Was everywhere here. The place was crawling with it. Out there, he had been on the edge of serious depression, and worse, he had been in danger of learning to really dislike himself. He was on the verge of incurring the kind of inward damage you didn't heal from, ever. But now he felt like Pinocchio, a wooden boy who was made real. Or maybe it was the other way around. He'd been turned from a real boy into something else? Either way, the change was for the better. It wasn't fillery, but it would do. He didn't spend all his time alone. Once in a while, he spotted Elliot from a distance, loping across the empty green or lolling with his long legs folded up in a window seat, staring out the window or leafing distractedly through a book. He had an air of magnificent, melancholy sophistication, as if his proper place were elsewhere, somewhere infinitely more compelling even than break bills, and he'd been confined to his present setting by a grotesque divine oversight, which he tolerated with as much good humor as could be expected. One day Quentin was walking the edge of the great lawn when he came across Elliot leaning against an oak tree, smoking a cigarette and reading a paperback book. It was more or less the same spot where they first met. Because of the odd way Elliot's jaw was built, the cigarette stuck out at an angle. "Want one?" Elliot asked politely. He stopped reading and held out a blue-and-white pack of Merit Ultralights. They hadn't spoken since Quentin's first day at Breakbills. "They're contraband," he went on, not visibly disappointed that Quentin didn't take one. "Chambers buys them for me. I once caught him in the wine cellar drinking a very good Petit Syrah from the Dean's private collection. Stag's Leap, the 96. We came to an understanding. He's really a nice fellow. I shouldn't hold it over his head. Quite a good amateur painter, albeit in a sadly outdated realist mode. I let him paint me once. Draped, thank you very much. I was holding a frisbee. I think I was supposed to be Hyacinthus. Chambers is a pompiste at heart. Deep down, I don't think he believes Impressionism ever happened." Quentin had never met anybody so staggeringly and unapologetically affected. It was hard to know how to respond. He summoned up all the wisdom he'd accumulated during his entire life in Brooklyn. "Merits are for pussies," he said. Elliot looked at him appraisingly. "Very true. But they're the only cigarette I can stand. Disgusting habit. Come on, smoke one with me." Quentin accepted the cigarette. He was in unfamiliar territory here. He'd handled cigarettes before. They were common props in close-up magic. But he'd never actually put one in his mouth. He made the cigarette vanish, a basic thumb palm, then snapped his fingers to bring it back. "I said smoke it, not fondle it," Elliot said curtly. He muttered something under his breath, then snapped his own fingers. A lighter-size flame sprang into being over the tip of his index finger. Quentin leaned in and inhaled. It felt like his lungs had been crumpled up and then incinerated. He coughed for 5 solid minutes without stopping. Elliot laughed so hard he had to sit down. Quentin's face was slick with tears. He forced himself to take another drag and threw up into a hedge. They spent the rest of that afternoon together. Maybe he felt guilty for giving Quentin the cigarette, or maybe Elliot had decided that the tedium of solitude was ever so slightly greater than the tedium of Quentin's company. Maybe he just needed a straight man. He led Quentin around the campus and lectured him on the underground lore of life at Breakbills. "The keen-eyed incoming freshman will have noticed the weather, which is uncommonly clement for November.
That's because it's still summer here. There are some very old spells on the Brakebill's grounds to keep people from spotting it from the river or walking in by accident, that kind of thing. Fine old enchantments, classic work of their kind. But they're getting eccentric in their old age, and somewhere in the 1950s, time started spinning off its axis here. Gets worse every year. Nothing to worry about in the larger picture, but we're a little behind the mainstream. 2 months, 28 days, give or take a few hours. Quentin didn't know whether to act as awestruck as he felt, or try to produce an imitation of cool, worldly ennui. He changed the subject and asked about the curriculum.
You won't have any choice about your schedule your first year.
Henry, Elliot only ever referred to Dean Fogg by his first name, makes everybody do the same thing. You smart? There was no non-embarrassing answer to this.
I guess.
Don't worry about it. Everybody here is. If they even brought you in for the exam, you were the smartest person in your school, teachers included. Everyone here was the cleverest little monkey in his or her particular tree, except now we're all in one tree together. It can be a shock. Not enough coconuts to go round. You'll be dealing with your equals for the first time in your life, and your betters. You won't like it. The work is different, too. It's not what you think. You don't just wave a wand and yell some made-up Latin. There's reasons why most people can't do it.
Which are what? Quentin asked.
The reasons why most people can't do magic?
Well, Elliot held up a long, thin finger.
One, it's very hard, and they're not smart enough. Two, it's very hard, and they're not obsessive and miserable enough to do all the work you have to do it right. Three, they lack the guidance and mentorship provided by the dedicated and startlingly charismatic faculty of the Brakebills College for Magical Pedagogy. And four, they lack the tough, starchy, moral fiber necessary to wield awesome magical energies calmly and responsibly. And five, he stuck up his thumb, some people have all that stuff and they still can't do it. Nobody knows why. They say the words, wave their arms, and nothing happens. Poor bastards, but that's not us. We're the lucky ones. We have it. Whatever it is.
I don't know if I have the moral fiber one.
I don't either. I think that one's optional, actually.
Silent for a while, they walked along a lush, ruler-straight allee of fence trees leading back toward the lawn. Elliot lit another cigarette.
"Listen, I don't want to pry," Quentin said, "but I'm assuming you have some secret magical way of dealing with the negative health effects of all those cigarettes."
"It's kind of you to ask.
I sacrifice a virgin schoolgirl every other fortnight by the light of a gibbous moon using a silver scalpel forged by Swiss albinos, who are also virgins. Clears my little lungs right up."
After that, Quentin saw Elliot most days. Elliot spent one entire afternoon teaching him how to navigate the hedge maze that separated the house, as everybody calls it, from the great lawn, which was officially named Seagrave's Lawn after the 18th-century dean who cleared and leveled it, and which everybody referred to as the sea, or sometimes the grave. There were six fountains scattered throughout the maze, and each had an official name, usually that of a deceased dean, as well as a nickname generated by the collective unconsciousness of generations of Brakebillian undergraduates. The hedges that made up the maze were cut in the shape of heavy, slow-thighed beasts, bears and elephants and other less easily identifiable creatures. Unlike ordinary topiary, they moved. They lumbered along very slowly, almost imperceptibly, wading half-submerged in the dark foliage like hippopotami, wallowing in an equatorial African river. On the last day before classes began, Elliot led him around to the front of the house, which looked out on the Hudson. There was a scrim of plane trees between the front terrace and the river, and a flight of wide stone steps that led down to a handsome Victorian boathouse. They decided on the spot that they absolutely had to go out on the water, even though neither of them had any practical ideas about how to do it. As Elliot pointed out, they were both certified sorcerer geniuses, and how hard could it be to row a damn boat? With a lot of grunting and yelling at each other, they wrestled a long wooden double skull down from the rafters. It was a fabulous object, strangely light, like the husk of a colossal stick insect, wreathed in cobwebs and redolent with the heady smell of wood varnish. Mostly by luck, they managed to turn it over and splash it down into the water without injuring it or themselves, or getting so pissed off at each other that they had to abandon the whole project. After some early close calls, they got it pointed in a plausible direction and settled into a slow, halting rhythm with it, hindered but not daunted by their incompetence and by the fact that Quentin was hopelessly out of shape and Elliot was both out of shape and a heavy smoker. They got about half a mile upstream before the summer day abruptly vanished around them and became chilly and gray. Quentin thought it was a summer squall until Elliot explained that they'd reached the outer limits of whatever concealment spells had been applied to the Brakebill's grounds, and it was November again. They wasted 20 minutes rowing up past the change and then drifting back down again, up and back, watching the sky change color, feeling the temperature drop and then soar and then drop again. They were too tired to row on the way back, so they drifted with the current. Elliot lay back in the skull and smoked and talked. Because of his air of infallible entitlement, Quentin assumed he'd been raised among the wealthy mandarins of Manhattan, but it turned out he'd actually grown up on a farm in eastern Oregon. "My parents are paid not to grow soybeans," he said. "I have 3 older brothers— magnificent physical specimens, kind-hearted, thick-necked, 3-sport athletes who drink Schlitz and feel sorry for me. My dad doesn't know what happened. He thinks he chewed too much dip before I was conceived, and that's why I didn't come out regular." Elliot stubbed out his merit in a glass ashtray balanced precariously on the glossy wooden hull and lit another one. "They think I'm at a special school for computer geeks and homosexuals. That's why I don't go home in the summertime. Henry doesn't care. I haven't been home since I started here." "You probably feel sorry for me," he went on, airily. He wore a dressing gown over his regular clothes, which gave him a shabby, princely look. "You shouldn't, you know. I'm very happy here. Some people need their families to become who they're supposed to be. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there are other ways to do it." Quentin hadn't realized how hard won Elliot's air of ludicrously exaggerated insouciance must be. That facade of lofty indifference must be there to hide real problems. Quentin liked to think of himself as a sort of regional champion of unhappiness— but he wondered if Elliot had him outclassed on that score, too. As they drifted home, they were passed by a few other boats, sailboats and cabin cruisers, and a hard-charging 8-woman scull out of West Point, which was a few miles upriver. The occupants looked grim and bundled up against the cold in gray sweatshirts and sweatpants. They couldn't perceive, or somehow weren't part of, the August heat that Quentin and Elliot were enjoying. They were warm and dry, and didn't even know it. The terms of the enchantment locked them out. Magic.
"The study of magic is not a science, it is not an art, and it is not a religion. Magic is a craft. When we do magic, we do not wish, and we do not pray. We rely upon our will and our knowledge and our skill to make a specific change to the world. This is not to say that we understand magic in the sense that physicists understand why subatomic particles do whatever it is that they do, or perhaps they don't understand that yet. I can never remember. In any case, we do not and cannot understand what magic is or where it comes from any more than a carpenter understands why a tree grows. He doesn't have to. He works.